Prior to the Masters, he called Feinstein and demanded a face-to-face meeting with him, his editor at Golf Magazine, Mike Perley, and the magazine's editor-in-chief, George Pepper. The meeting took place over breakfast at Augusta, and Norton showed up with his IMG colleague, Clark Jones. It got off to a bad start when Jones demanded to know the identity of Feinstein's unnamed sources. "Clark, if I wanted you to know that, I'd have used their names in the magazine," Feinstein said. "Well, I want to know right now," Clark said. "Can't have everything you want in life, Clark," Feinstein retorted. Then Norton jumped in, suggesting that if Feinstein didn't cooperate, Tiger might decide to sign a contract as a playing editor with Golf Digest instead of Golf Magazine. At the time, Tiger was in talks with both publications. Norton's not-so-subtle threat brought the breakfast to an abrupt and ugly end as Feinstein turned to his editors and said, "If you want to stay and eat with these two assholes, go ahead, but I have better things to do than listen to this crap." A week later, Feinstein hammered Tiger for skipping the Jackie Robinson celebration at Shea Stadium. It became clear to Tiger that if he wanted Feinstein to back off, he was going to have to take matters into his own hands. He sent word through a PGA Tour PR rep that he wanted to meet with Feinstein, but with everything else that was going on in his life, he had to postpone the showdown. Tiger flew straight from Cancun to the Nike offices in Beaverton, Oregon. By the time he landed, his decision to snub the president had reached beyond the sports pages and was making headlines in Washington. Maureen Dowd, the New York Times political writer with a reputation for skewering presidents and senators, wrote a column titled, "Tiger's Double Bogey." In it, she suggested that Tiger was more interested in money than in honoring Robinson. It is perplexing why a young man with such a long shelf life, as his agent puts it, could not have paused on the merchandising mania for a couple of days. Eventually, Tiger would come to the conclusion that he had made a mistake, but years would pass before he would get around to writing a letter of apology to Rachel Robinson. At 21, he still had some growing up to do. One day after the Dowd column ran, Tiger got word that fellow golfer Fuzzy Zoeller had made some racially insensitive comments about him during the final round of the Masters. A reporter for CNN's Pro Golf Weekly had interviewed Zoeller while Tiger was working his way through the back nine on the final day. By that point, it was a foregone conclusion that he would win, and the reporter asked Zoeller what he thought about Tiger. "He's doing quite well," Zoeller said. "Pretty impressive. That little boy is driving well and he's putting well. He's doing everything it takes to win, so you know what you guys do when he gets in there. You pat him on the back and say congratulations and enjoy it, and tell him not to serve fried chicken next year at the champions' dinner that the winner would host the following year at the Masters. Got it?" Zoeller then paused, snapped his fingers, turned away from the camera, and then turned back to add, "Or collard greens, or whatever the hell they serve." The comments aired on CNN 1 week after Tiger had won the Masters were instantly compared to Los Angeles Dodgers executive Al Campanis' infamous interview with Ted Koppel in 1987, where he mused that blacks may not have some of the necessities to be, let's say, a field manager or perhaps a general manager. A former teammate of Jackie Robinson's, Campanis was the general manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers when he made that statement, and it ended up costing him his job. Zoeller's comments brought many of the same old stereotypes back to the forefront of the news, presenting Tiger with another critical decision. How should he respond? Tiger was familiar with Zoeller's reputation as a joker who made light of everything. He couldn't have meant anything ugly, Tiger thought. At the same time, he wondered why Zoeller had said those words as Tiger was approaching his historic victory. His comments had a racist tinge, Tiger thought. Would it matter if he meant what he said as a joke? If he had, it sure didn't come across as funny. Confused and angry, Tiger initially chose to say nothing. When Zoeller reached out to him by phone, Tiger didn't call him back. In a public statement, Zoeller apologized, claiming that his comments weren't intended to be racially derogatory. "It's too bad that something I said in jest was turned into something it's not, but I didn't mean anything by it, and I'm sorry if I offended anybody. If Tiger is offended by it, I apologize to him too." As Zoeller's statement got picked up by media outlets, Tiger flew to Chicago and sat for an interview with Oprah Winfrey that was set to air later in the week. He was joined on stage by his father. Tiger anticipated questions about race, but Oprah surprised him by reading aloud a letter that Earl had written to him. "Dear Tiger, you are my little man. You are my treasure. God gave you to me to nurture and to grow and to develop. I always have had your interests first and foremost in my life, and it will always be so. In fact, you mean more to me than life itself. I can remember when I taught you that it was okay to cry, that men can cry. It was not a sign of weakness, but a sign of strength. I pass on all my abilities to share and to care with you. I realize that you have an infinitely higher capacity and capability to perpetuate this philosophy in our day's world. I trust that I have given you the guidance and love in which you can then execute that mission. What God has in mind for you, I don't know. It is not my call. It is my job to prepare you. I trust that I have done the best job that I can. I know you will give it your all and that you will be my little man forever. Love, Pop. Tears streaming down his cheeks, Tiger wiped his eyes. He almost never allowed himself to show emotion, but for the second time in 8 days he was crying on national television. It was no doubt an unusual and overwhelming experience. Earl didn't often express love and affection within the walls of his home, yet here he was doing it with Oprah in plain view of the millions of people watching from their living rooms. Oprah also raised the subject of Tiger's heritage, asking him if it bothered him to be referred to as African American. It does, Tiger said. Growing up, I came up with this name. I'm Cablanasian. It was a term that Tiger and some friends had coined when he was attending Stanford. I'm just who I am, he told Oprah, whoever you see in front of you. Tiger didn't think he was disrespecting blacks, nor was he trying to alienate anyone. But his comments were proof that he was still learning how to navigate the thorny subject of race in America. His views on a variety of important social issues were nowhere near as advanced as his golf game. He had been under the influence of his father's opinions for so long that there hadn't been enough time for his own to evolve, and the spotlight afforded him no margin for mistakes. Even before his interview with Oprah ran, 2 days after the taping, the Associated Press in Chicago previewed the segment under the headline, Tiger Woods Doesn't Want to Be Called African American. The story landed the same day that Kmart announced it had dropped Fuzzy Zoller for making racially insensitive remarks about Tiger. Just when it looked like he was getting past the Jackie Robinson fiasco, Tiger was thrust back into an even sharper debate about race. NPR went to Harlem and did a whole show based on the slogan, I am Tiger Woods. Congress announced it was holding hearings to explore how the federal government defines and measures race and ethnicity in preparation for the next U.S. Census, and some lawmakers were advocating for a new mixed-race category. Time magazine ran a 5-page spread titled, I'm Just Who I Am, quoting Tiger. The piece included a big photo of Tiger and his parents. Dealing with all this was a lot more taxing than mastering the game of golf. Tiger reluctantly issued a statement on Fuzzy Zoller, saying his attempt at humor was out of bounds. But he himself had never apologized to African Americans for his own out-of-bounds jokes that had been published in GQ, an inconsistency that New York Times columnist Dave Anderson immediately pointed out in a column titled, Tiger Woods Also Needs to Apologize for Distasteful Jokes. Tiger was starting to feel like a piñata, getting hit on all sides, no matter what he said. By the time a reporter from USA Today raised yet again his decision to turn down President Clinton, asking what the reason was, Tiger unloaded. Well, one is, I had planned my vacation already, Tiger said, and two, why didn't Mr. Clinton invite me before the Masters? If he wanted me there, I think it would have been best if he would have asked me before. Yet in the midst of all the criticism, Tiger's popularity soared. A Wall Street Journal / NBC News poll published weeks after the Masters found that Tiger had shot past Michael Jordan as the most popular athlete in America. Only 2% of respondents gave Tiger a negative rating, and according to the poll, he was more popular than Norman Schwarzkopf and Colin Powell the week after the Gulf War ended. Tiger even had a 74% positive rating among Southern whites. Only Robert E. Lee ever got a bigger number from the white South, the lead pollster said. The results reinforced a powerful truth. In the eyes of fans, winning and greatness in athletics overshadow frailties in human character. All that talk about distasteful jokes in GQ and snubbing the leader of the free world and missing Jackie Robinson's commemoration and distancing himself from his African roots was just noise. People didn't really care what Tiger had to say about social issues or whether he considered himself black or Asian or Cablanasian. His athletic dominance was every bit as entertaining as Babe Ruth's had been in the 20s. Every time Tiger had a club in his hands, audiences were riveted. They expected something magical to happen, and more often than not, it did. That was all that really mattered. Chapter 13. Changes. Tiger's life was evolving so fast that he couldn't escape the feeling of being constantly off balance. As an introvert, He bristled under the strain of a microscope that seemed to get stronger and more intrusive by the day. Everywhere he went, the mall, fast food restaurants, movie theaters, sparked a small riot. Between autographs, photographs, and the endless line of interruptions, he found it exhausting to be out in public. Side doors and back entrances became his entries and exits of choice. In hopes of clearing his head, he took a month off following his victory at Augusta, but the golf course was the only place where he felt comfortable and completely in control, and in mid-May he returned to the tour at the Byron Nelson Golf Classic in Dallas. Interest in him was so fervent that the tournament was forced to cut off ticket sales after 100,000 one-day passes and 50,000 weekly passes were sold. Determined and confident, Tiger started strong, but in the early rounds he felt that something wasn't right with his swing. He was still playing better than everyone else, but he was winning with his putting and his short game. Things felt slightly off-kilter with his ball striking, especially off the tee. Concerned, at the end of the third round, he called Butch Harmon, who immediately drove up from Houston so they could work on his swing before the final round. On Sunday, despite going head-to-head with a Game 7 playoff contest between the New York Knicks and the Miami Heat on television, the Byron Nelson experienced a 158% jump in viewership from the previous year. More than 85,000 fans jammed the grounds of the Four Seasons Resort to watch Tiger. Feeding off the crowds, he ended the day the same way he started it, two strokes ahead of everyone else. As he walked off the 18th green with another victory notch in his belt, he received a hug from the Duchess of York, Sarah Fergie Ferguson, who had flown over from England to walk the course with Tiger's mother. The win pushed Tiger to number one on the PGA Tour money list for the year, with almost $1.3 million in just 8 starts. He was the youngest player in history to earn $1 million in a season and the first to surpass $2 million in overall career earnings. He'd achieved the milestone in fewer events than any golfer in tour history. It hadn't even been a year since Tiger had turned pro, and it already seemed like everyone else was playing for second place. Like Jack Nicklaus, he expected to win. Now with Big Jack in the twilight of his storied career, Woods was in a league of his own. But Tiger couldn't stop worrying about his swing. He went to Golf Channel headquarters in Orlando and watched the tapes of his performance at Augusta. He found more than a dozen things he wanted to change. The position of the club at the top of his swing, aesthetically, it could be better. His short irons, he couldn't judge them particularly well. His movement off the ball, it was beautiful, but the club was across the target line, pointing well to the right of the spot he was aiming at. Plus, his club face was closed down. His list of grievances went on and on. God almighty, he thought. Harmon, however, wasn't concerned when he looked at the tapes. It was true that Tiger's club was slightly shut at the top, and his hands were opening up a bit on the follow-through. But he had won the Masters, the Byron Nelson, and a handful of other tournaments. He had the sweetest swing on the tour. Why mess with success? I want to change this, Tiger said. I want to do it now. Harmon could hear the determination in his voice. It wasn't up for debate. So he suggested a more methodical approach. We can do it a little bit at a time, he said. No, Tiger insisted. I want to do it all right now. Harmon was in awe. None other than Jack Nicklaus himself had described Tiger's Masters triumph as perhaps the finest tournament performance in PGA Tour history. Yet Tiger wanted to completely revamp his swing, not make subtle adjustments, but tear it apart and construct a new version from the ground up. That realization raised some frightening possibilities. It also begged the question, what drives Tiger Woods? Part of the answer resides in an observation that Coltita once made about her husband. He couldn't relax, she said of Earl, searching for something, always searching, never satisfied. With Earl, the trait of never being satisfied with one woman, with one drink, with any amount of money, led to some compulsive behaviors that had consequences for both his wife and his son. Tiger, to a certain degree, had inherited his father's restlessness. But at age 21, his chronic dissatisfaction centered almost entirely on his performance. Beating other golfers or winning tournaments was never going to be enough for Tiger Woods. Even being ranked number one in the world didn't bring satisfaction. Golf, for him, was always so much more than a game. I was in it to find the answer to one question, how good can I be, Tiger explained years later. I suppose I was searching for perfection, although that's not attainable in golf except for short stretches. I wanted total control of my swing, and hence the ball. The quest for total control led him to form some compulsive habits of his own. By the spring of 1997, Tiger was consumed with practicing and working out. A typical practice day for him entailed hitting 600 balls, working on his short game and putting, playing around, sometimes on his own, and working out in the gym for 2 to 3 hours. That was the life I wanted, he said. In her book, Just Can't Stop, An Investigation of Compulsion, longtime science writer Sharon Begley references a growing body of scientific evidence that concludes compulsions are responses to anxiety. Compulsions come from a need so desperate, burning, and tortured, it makes us feel like a vessel filling with steam, saturating us with a hot urgency that demands relief, Begley writes. They are an outlet valve, a consequence of anxiety as inevitable as burst pipes are a consequence of water freezing within a building's plumbing. Specifically, Begley cites creative geniuses like Ernest Hemingway, who felt so compelled to write every day that he once remarked, "When I don't write, I feel like shit." Hemingway's drive may have come from a dark, tortured place, but as Begley points out, it drove him to literary immortality. Tiger Woods had developed habits that put him on a path toward golfing immortality. It would not be inaccurate to say that when he didn't practice, he felt like shit. The joy he derived from winning tournaments was always fleeting. Even shattering records at Augusta wasn't enough. "I didn't care that I won by 12 shots," he later admitted. "I knew what I needed to do, but you knew what I needed to do, and above all, I wanted to do it. I thrived on working on my swing. I was addicted to staying on the range for hours." As a practical matter, changing a swing that virtually everyone envied as the greatest in golf was bizarre and risky. Harmon warned Tiger that until he perfected his new swing, he would very likely see a drop-off in his performance. He might not win another tournament for quite some time. Tiger's willingness to go along with Harmon's plan to create a new swing floored his coach. It's common for elite athletes to constantly look for ways to maintain their edge and refine their skills. But there was no precedent for an athlete at the top of a sport to step down from the pinnacle for a prolonged period of time in hopes of getting better. In so many ways, Tiger was mature far beyond his years when it came to golf. He was also a risk-taker. Abandoning the swing that had enabled him to conquer Augusta at age 21 would expose him to harsh criticism and force him to endure something he wasn't used to, losing again and again. But it might also propel him to immortality. Sure, he could win the Masters, but Augusta happened to be perfectly suited to his strengths. In order to win the U.S. Open, the British Open, and the PGA Championship, he knew he needed more control off the tee. The fairways at those tournaments weren't as forgiving as Augusta's. "I needed to tighten my swing if I was going to have a chance of winning them," he said. "I needed a swing that I could trust 100%, and he wanted the Holy Grail." On the eve of the Western Open on July 2, 1997, Tiger treated Mark O'Meara to dinner and a movie, Men in Black. O'Meara couldn't help wondering what was up, because normally Tiger never paid for anything. Whenever they went out, O'Meara always picked up the tab, but Tiger was in a celebratory mood. He was the number one ranked golfer in the world, and he was about to do something radical that might change that. But first, he planned to tee it up one more time with the swing that had gotten him to the top. On the first day at Cog Hill Golf and Country Club outside Chicago, tournament organizers had to turn people away after 60,000 fans showed up. It was Michael Jordan's town, but Tiger clearly owned it for 4 days. Feeling rested for the first time in weeks, he never doubted that he was going to win. By the end of the third round, the other golfers had come to the same conclusion when Tiger was tied for the lead. He had already established a reputation for not relinquishing leads. That proved to be true once again, and by the 15th hole of the final round, he had the victory firmly in hand. An estimated 55,000 people packed the 18th fairway to witness his final hole. As soon as his second shot was airborne and Tiger started to walk toward his ball, thousands of fans, many of them teenagers, broke through the ropes in a spontaneous eruption of joy. "They can't hold us back," someone yelled. Unfazed and smiling, Tiger walked carefree down the fairway, leading the masses in a scene that looked like something out of a Frank Capra film. Then, after tapping in his final putt, he hurled his ball into the gallery. The Western Open was Tiger's fourth victory on the PGA Tour in 1997. He admitted afterward that he hadn't played his best golf, but he had won by using what he called his greatest weapon, my creative mind. It was a subtle way of saying that when he put his mind to it, he should be able to win. Earl was blunter. "If Tiger shows up with his A game, I don't care what game those other guys have. Tiger's going to win. It's that simple." Earl was right, but Tiger knew something that even his father didn't yet understand. When he left Chicago, he would walk away from the swing that had taken him to the top. He wouldn't win again until May 1998, and it would take 22 months for him to master his new swing. For a guy whose favorite word was compete, Tiger was about to hit a mental wall that would test his resolve to stick with the belief that he was doing the right thing for the long run. Chapter 14, Exploited. Right after turning pro, Tiger had made it clear that while he would do everything that Nike and Titleist required of him, he didn't want to do more endorsement work than that. But the lure of easy money was too strong to resist, especially for IMG. Tiger was the sports agency's most prized commodity, and Norton was working to open up as many revenue streams and capture as many commissions as possible. Earl approved of Norton's approach, and Tiger went along with it. First, it was the Planet Hollywood deal, aligning Tiger with the company's all-star cafes. Then came the rush of endorsement opportunities following the Masters. On May 19, 1997, one day after winning the Byron Nelson, Tiger flew to New York to announce his new sponsorship deal with American Express. The financial services giant had gone all in, paying Woods $13 million over 5 years, including $5 million up front, with another $1 million donated to Tiger's foundation to benefit minority golf. A dedicated American Express financial advisor was added to Tiger's team of lawyers and accountants. He also received an American Express Centurion Black Titanium card, typically offered only to members who charged upward of $450,000 per year on their card. At 21, he may have been the youngest person in the world with a black card, and its annual $5,000 fee was waived. American Express felt it had secured the ideal global personality to help market its products to consumers in Asia and South America, where growth was occurring in both golf and credit cards. In Tiger Woods, we have a representative who has captured the imagination of many different kinds of people, said company president Kenneth I. Chenault. It's hard to visualize anyone he wouldn't appeal to. A little over a week later, Rolex announced it had signed an endorsement deal with Tiger, paying him a reported $7 million over a 5-year period. The company planned to repurpose its Tudor brand of watches in order to market them to a younger generation of consumers. The new watches would bear Tiger's name, and he would appear in television and print advertising campaigns. At the same time, Earl was cashing in on Tiger's success. His book, Training a Tiger, A Father's Guide to Raising a Winner in Both Golf and Life, was published by HarperCollins in early April 1997. The initial print run was 70,000 copies. The day after Tiger won the Masters, the publisher called for a second printing of 20,000 copies. Then Earl went on the Oprah Winfrey Show, which led to more talk show appearances where he continued to emphasize his role in Tiger's success. He has to have someone to talk to and to reach out to and a shoulder to lean on, Earl told Charlie Rose. You saw it on the 18th green at Augusta on the final day when he was on my shoulder. That's home. That's his comfort zone. And his mother? Rose asked. His mother to a degree, Earl said. Mother is mother. But in our family, there is father. Earl's book ended up selling more than 233,000 copies in hardback and almost 60,000 copies in paperback. It was so successful that he signed a contract to write a follow-up book titled Playing Through, Straight Talk on Hard Work, Big Dreams, and Adventures with Tiger. It would come out in the spring of 1998. IMG was happy. Earl was happy. Tiger was feeling stressed out. He certainly didn't mind the money that was pouring in. After earning $13.1 million in the abbreviated 1996 season, he took home $21.8 million in 1997, and the majority of it, $19.5 million, was from endorsements. But everyone was pulling at him. On top of all the time commitments to his corporate partners, he was being pressured to get busy writing his instructional book for Warner Books. The publishing house had already paid him a substantial advance, and it was itching to take advantage of Tiger's red-hot name by getting the book onto the shelves. I don't have time for this shit, Tiger snapped at Jamie Diaz, who had been talking to Norton about writing the book with him. With everything else that was going on, Tiger had soured on the idea of writing an instruction book, and he certainly didn't want to think about an autobiography. Plus, Earl had gotten angry when he discovered that Norton had pitched Tiger's book idea without clearing it with him first. The whole publishing business was starting to turn Tiger off. It felt like more and more people were trying to make money off him. Even before he had won the Masters, Sports Illustrated's Tim Rosefort published Tiger Woods, The Making of a Champion. Then after the Masters, John Strege's book Tiger, A Biography of Tiger Woods came out, infuriating Tiger. To him, it seemed like everyone who got close to him was exploiting his fame for profit. People have something to gain off of me instead of just being a good friend, he said at the time. Streed saw it differently. He had started covering Tiger for the Orange County Register back when he was a young teen. Due to his close relationship with the family, he had approached Earl in September 1996, right after Tiger turned pro, and told him that he wanted to write a book. Earl gave Streed his blessing, and Cultita even gave him access to the scrapbook she had compiled over the first 20 years of Tiger's life. In less than 3 months, Streed banged out a 238-page book. But when it came out, he got the cold shoulder. He sent a copy to Earl and Cultita, but they never responded. Hughes Norton stopped taking his calls, too. Norton's secretary finally informed Streed that he'd been cut off from the family. Streed even wrote a favorable column about Tiger for Golf Digest, but when one of the magazine's photographers approached Tiger on Streed's behalf in hopes of reviving the friendship, it didn't go well. John Streed wrote a pretty good column about you, the photographer said. Did you see it? Fuck John Streed, Tiger told him. After years of a close relationship, one in which the Woods family regularly called on Streed for help and to get stories about Tiger strategically placed in the paper, Streed never heard from the Woodses again. Tiger, in particular, ostracized him. It occurred to me that to be his friend, you had to be his friend exclusively on his terms, Streed concluded. In between rounds at the 1997 Masters, Tiger played Mortal Kombat, a fantasy fighting video game that was notorious for its bloody violence. In particularly graphic finishing moves, known as fatalities, were instrumental in prompting the creation of a rating system for video games. Mortal Kombat was just one of several games that Tiger indulged in on and off the tour. At one point, he spent an entire week hidden away in his Isleworth home, lying on the couch playing video games. In terms of endorsements, the one deal that Tiger genuinely wanted was a partnership with a video game company, but that had become another source of frustration. In the summer of 1997, a small team from EA Sports met with Tiger and Norton in Isleworth. At that point, EA, with its cocky slogan, "If it's in the game, it's in the game," was the 800-pound gorilla in video games. Riding the wave of Madden NFL and the global success of FIFA soccer, EA had a business model that aggressively targeted teenage boys in what it liked to call the fraternity couch, where all college guys were equal, no matter their size or success with women. The company had long held the exclusive PGA Tour license, but that franchise was floundering, sitting a distant fourth on the EA pecking order behind Madden, FIFA, and NHL hockey. From a gaming standpoint, the PGA Tour's conservative mindset and its middle-aged demographic didn't connect with EA's target audience. But then came Tiger Woods, looking like a potential white knight armed with the kind of image that would retrofit the game to appeal to youth. Nevertheless, when Norton reached out to EA, its executives weren't convinced that Tiger was a legitimate gamer and felt that there could be no fooling the target audience, guys who live, breathe, and play video games on a daily basis. So before being willing to put up millions of dollars to hire Tiger as a spokesman, EA's team wanted to test his bona fides in the clubhouse at the country club near his home. He didn't disappoint. When asked what kind of games he played, Tiger was exact. "I don't play a ton of sports games," he told them. "I like driving games. I like shooting games. Need for Speed, Halo, Mortal Kombat." Tiger was also versed in the design of the games, and he made it clear that if he signed on to endorse a golf game for EA, he would insist on being involved in the details. He wanted the game to be authentic. Tiger's answers were exactly what EA had hoped to hear, and when Norton started pushing for a deal, EA was ready to sign. But the negotiations stalled because of a contract dispute between IMG and Nike, one that boiled down to a single subclause regarding Tiger's interactive rights. Nike owned them, and wanted to sell them to EA to help offset the millions they were paying Woods. Mike Shapiro, the Tiger Woods brand manager at Nike, said Norton didn't realize this until he pointed it out to him. Norton and his team at IMG had brilliantly orchestrated a remarkable number of deals for Tiger in a very short time. Many of them were complicated, and none more so than the Nike agreement. In the hundreds of pages of terms negotiated on Tiger's behalf, IMG seemed to have overlooked this critical provision. Norton wanted a face-to-face meeting with Shapiro, who agreed to come to Cleveland. He had barely sat down in IMG's conference room when Norton started in on him. "As far as Team Tiger is concerned," Norton told him, "we retain those rights." "Read the contract," Shapiro said. "I read it," Norton said. "We own the rights." "That's not an objective interpretation," Shapiro said flatly. "It says we have video game rights." The meeting was tense, and it ended badly. A small man with a huge ego, Norton relished a good fight, whether it was squabbling over the tiniest detail with his ex-wife in divorce court or holding the line on a subclause in a client's contract. In many ways, Norton's personality shaped the way he went about trying to maximize endorsement opportunities for his superstar clients. But he suddenly found himself in a standoff with Tiger's biggest corporate partner. Nike's lawyers held their ground, and Mike Shapiro wasn't the least bit intimidated by Norton's tactics. Before joining Nike, Shapiro had been the vice president of business affairs at Turner Sports, where he negotiated telecast rights with the NFL, NBA, PGA Tour, and Major League Baseball. Prior to that, he'd been general counsel of the San Francisco Giants. He knew contracts and he knew rights. There would be no endorsement deal between Tiger and EA without Nike's approval. The acrimony between Norton and Shapiro drove Tiger up the wall. "What's going on?" Tiger asked Shapiro. "Can't you just work this fucking thing out?" "Well, Hughes and I have different opinions on things," Shapiro told him. "Well, fuck that," Tiger said. "Just work it out. Hughes is bad-mouthing you. You're bad-mouthing him." Norton ended up losing the argument, but he exacted revenge by playing hardball with Tiger's time. Tiger's eventual deal with EA guaranteed that the video game company would have 2 or 3 days of Tiger each year for marketing and design development, the latter requiring green screen motion capture photography and dozens of on-course shots. Norton, according to Shapiro, made it difficult for EA to get onto Tiger's calendar. When dates finally opened up, the shoots were conducted on Tiger's turf and run with military efficiency from dawn to dusk. If EA had 3 hours blocked to shoot a TV commercial in which Woods had 8 lines, once those lines were done to Tiger's satisfaction, the shoot was over. Tiger also said no when EA's marketing team wanted gamers to drive the ball 500 yards off the tee. "I can hit it 340 with the wind," Tiger told them, "not 500. In 1998, EA released the game Tiger Woods 99 PGA Tour Golf. It was a runaway success. Nike had big plans for Tiger. In hopes of leveraging its star athlete to expand the company's brand in the lucrative Asian market, it created the Tiger Woods Invitational Tournament in Tokyo, which took place in early November 1997. The tournament featured Nick Price, Mark O'Meara, and Shigeki Maruyama, and it marked Tiger's first trip to Japan. Massive crowds turned out to see him play, but from the moment he arrived, he was wary and aloof. A week earlier, he had wrapped up the PGA Tour for the year with a 12th place finish in the Tour Championship. The week before that, he had crapped out at the Las Vegas Invitational thanks to a terrible third round. Earlier in the summer, he had finished 19th at the U.S. Open, 24th at the British Open, and 29th at the PGA Championship. Golf writers were already starting to suggest that he was in a slump, and more than one tour pro was whispering that golf's great new hope was human after all. Some of them seemed to find satisfaction in his struggles. "Tiger is proving to be a lot like everybody else on the PGA Tour," quipped Greg Norman at the end of the 1997 season. "Tiger got off to a phenomenal fast start, but he's come back to reality, and he's just another golfer out there." Word had gotten around that Tiger was working on his swing, but he'd been customarily secretive about it. No one realized that he had abandoned his championship swing and was learning an entirely new approach, nor did guys like Norman appreciate the demands that came with the kind of stardom that reached far beyond the world of golf. Wishing he could just disappear, Tiger had reluctantly agreed to sit for a 30-minute on-camera interview with Fox Sports, which had purchased the U.S. rights to the Tokyo event. He was so reluctant to do the interview that it took the network a month of negotiations to settle on a time and location, but it was finally set for a Friday night in a Tokyo hotel. That afternoon, as Tiger was sitting in a helicopter at the tournament course waiting to be ferried back to Tokyo for the interview, a woman climbed on board. Looking out the window, Tiger paid no attention to her. "Hi, Tiger," she said. "I'm Deb Gelman, and I work with Nike." Tiger turned and looked at her. "Hi," he said. "I'm Jose Cuervo." Then he turned and continued to stare out the window. He didn't say another word on the flight. Gelman worked as a producer for Nike Sports and Entertainment, the company's newest division. One of her jobs was to make sure Woods showed up for the interview. At the hotel, Tiger went with her to the penthouse suite, where he sat down with Roy Hamilton, a former first-round pick of the Detroit Pistons who had become one of the most prominent African-Americans in sports television. Tiger wasn't interested in pleasantries. The clock started ticking the moment he entered the room, and precisely 30 minutes later, he stood up and removed the microphone that had been clipped to his shirt. Fox had set up a table with memorabilia, pin flags, posters, and such. Hamilton asked Tiger if he would mind signing some things. Without saying a word, Tiger walked past the table and left the room. To those present, he came across as cold, but he was constantly being asked to autograph collector's items. Fans at tournaments had gotten so aggressive that he'd been cut under the eye on a couple of occasions when stray pens were pushed in front of his face. No matter where he went in public, he was stopped by strangers who wanted signatures and photos. The cumulative effect of this barrage forced him to put up some boundaries. At tournaments, he tried to accommodate children, but even there he was leery of memorabilia hounds who would use kids as runners to get things signed that would then be sold in stores and at shows. At events that were organized by his corporate sponsors, Tiger signed anything and everything, spending more time than most athletes interacting with the people in attendance. But the table full of memorabilia at the hotel in Tokyo didn't fit into that category. His deal with Fox said nothing about signing flags and balls and programs, so he didn't. The following morning, Tiger was scheduled to appear at a golf clinic prior to the final round, but he failed to show, disappointing hundreds of kids. Instead, he arrived at the course just in time to play. It appeared that he had had too much to drink the night before and was still feeling the effects. He asked a friend if he had any breath mints or gum. "I do," Gelman chimed in. "Meet me on every tee and every green on every hole," Tiger told her. It was the first time he had spoken to her since the initial meeting on the helicopter. But for the next 18 holes, Gelman was suddenly Tiger's best friend. When the round was over, he didn't say thank you or goodbye. He just disappeared. "He struck me as so unhappy," Gelman said in 2015. "Everyone wanted a piece of him. He was so wary. It was very evident he didn't trust anyone not in his inner circle." On Monday, January 5th, 1998, Tiger was in San Diego preparing for the Mercedes Championships. He also saw an opportunity to take up some unfinished business. John Feinstein was in San Diego, too. He was conducting interviews with PGA Tour pros for his forthcoming book, The Majors, in pursuit of golf's holy grail. Tiger sent word to him that he wanted to meet that night at a seaside restaurant. Before Feinstein arrived, Tiger asked for a corner table, and he was sitting there when Feinstein showed up.
"Couldn't wait to see me, huh?" Feinstein said, trying to break the ice with a joke.
"Actually, I'm just hungry," Tiger said flatly, choosing not to see the humor.
They didn't exactly hit it off, but over a long dinner they hashed out their differences, especially Feinstein's comparison of Earl Woods to Stefano Capriati.
"I really don't think your dad is different than any other pushy grab-the-bucks father," Feinstein told him, "except for one thing, you're his son. So I give him some credit for your genes, because you're smart enough and tough enough to deal with everything he's pushed on you and still be a great player. Most kids aren't that way. I think you've succeeded in spite of your father, not because of your father." Showing no emotion, Tiger defended Earl. He also pushed back when Feinstein pointed out that Earl had written a book that bragged about how he had created Tiger. "He just did that because so many people asked him, 'How did you do it?'" Tiger said. He figured it was easier to write a book than to try to answer the question a million times.
"Really?" Feinstein said. "Then why did he write the second book?"
Tiger stared at Feinstein. Then he laughed and said, "Good one." The back and forth was like a chess match. Tiger was looking for weakness and finding little. He brought up the breakfast at Augusta when Feinstein had walked out on Norton and Jones. "I have to admit, you surprised them," Tiger said. "I think they figured going to your boss would get your attention." Feinstein explained that he didn't really have a boss. He made most of his money from writing books, not covering golf for Golf Magazine. Tiger eased back in his chair. "So that's it," he said. "You really don't need any one job."
"No, I don't," Feinstein said. "Makes it tougher to intimidate you, doesn't it?"
At the end of the night, Feinstein thanked Tiger for arranging the dinner. "You don't need me to like you or to write or say good things about you," Feinstein said. "You're Tiger fucking Woods. I think it says a lot about you that you did this. And I learned a lot tonight, not just about why we disagree on things, but also about who you are." Nodding, Tiger said, "What'd you learn about me?" "That you're smarter than I thought you were." Before parting, Feinstein told Tiger that he had a mini-book about him coming out in a few weeks. "I'll get you a copy as soon as I have one," he said. "It basically says the same things about your dad that we discussed tonight."
"I probably shouldn't read it then," Tiger said.
"Probably not, but I don't want you to be blindsided by it. I'll stick it in your locker when I get it." It seemed as though any ill feelings between them had been aired and resolved. At least, that was how Feinstein felt. He and Tiger continued to exchange friendly hellos when they would see each other at tournaments, and eventually, Tiger acceded to Feinstein's request to do a sit-down interview for the majors. At Tiger's suggestion,
The interview was scheduled for the end of the year in Atlanta during the tour championship. But Tiger was a lot like his parents when it came to grudges. Forgive and forget were not part of their vocabulary. Earl never forgave a slight, and neither did Tita. Similarly, Tiger had a hard time letting go. 2 months after the dinner in San Diego, Feinstein placed a copy of his new mini-book in Tiger's locker during a tournament. As he had warned, the book defended his previous articles comparing Earl Woods to Stefano Capriati. "The comparisons are legitimate," Feinstein wrote. "Both fathers willingly turned their children into meal tickets long before they had turned pro. The only job Earl Woods has held since 1988 was the one provided for him by Hughes Norton and IMG." The passage delivered a fresh blow to Earl's dignity. Nothing angered Tiger like public criticism of his father. The other thing he couldn't stand was people profiting off him, especially journalists. Feinstein, in Tiger's eyes, had managed to do both. Chapter 15. Instincts. The week of the 1998 Masters, Tiger appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated, posing with a 650-pound white Bengal tiger named Samson. The exotic beast, along with another tiger of the same size named Dimitri, had been flown to Isleworth for a photo shoot in the country club's posh ballroom. The magazine had pitched the idea of photographing Tiger with a couple of genuine adult male tigers to Hughes Norton, who had serious reservations. If something went wrong, the consequences could be horrific. As it turned out, right before Tiger arrived, something did go wrong. Samson lost his footing on the canvas that had been hung for the photo backdrop and got spooked. The animal darted across the room, causing SI's creative director to bolt for the door. Norton was not pleased to see the tiger still growling when Woods walked in. But Tiger went right up to Samson, and the animal immediately calmed down. David McMillan, the tiger's handler, was amazed. "That young man projects supreme confidence like no one I've ever seen," he told the magazine. "You can't fake that with a big cat." Samson sensed no weakness or fear in Tiger, just power and inner peace. The encounter spoke volumes about Tiger's ability to mask his true feelings. For his entire life, he'd been disguising his emotions from friends, from opponents, from the media. Even an animal that thrived on instincts had misread Woods. The truth was that in April 1998, the circumstances of Tiger's life were giving him very little inner peace. While posing for the cover with the Tigers, Woods was dealing with death threats. It was part of the ugly consequences of extreme fame. He never talked publicly about the threats, nor did he report them. But on the eve of the 98 Masters, he disclosed the situation to Mark and Alicia O'Mara. They immediately invited Tiger to stay with them at Augusta. He could lie low, and no one would know his whereabouts. For 20 years, O'Mara had rented a home from Peggy Lewis, a local schoolteacher in Augusta, who, like many people in the area, supplemented her income by making her house available for the week of the Masters. There was an extra bedroom. Tiger took them up on the offer. Standing 6'1", Tiger arrived at the 1998 Masters weighing 170 pounds. A 20-pound increase from his weight at the 97 Masters. The extra weight was all muscle. He'd been spending an inordinate amount of time in the gym, powerlifting. Although he already hit the ball harder and farther than anyone on the tour, he craved more explosiveness off the tee. In his words, he wanted to really tear through the ball from the top of his backswing. Through personal study, he concluded that he should develop his fast twitch muscles by lifting heavy weights at a fast pace and supplementing his weight training with a lot of sprinting. He also developed his slow twitch muscle fibers by doing long endurance runs and alternating his fast pace lifts with slower pace lifts. Often that meant two workouts a day. Bench pressing 225 pounds and squatting more than 300 pounds, he had a physique that was unlike that of any other golfer on tour. He was starting to look like a defensive back in the NFL. But Tiger was tired. He'd spent the entire week before the Masters resting up in Isleworth, and it had helped to a certain extent. He played consistently in the tournament, shooting 71, 72, 72, and 70. It was a far cry from his performance a year earlier, but not bad for being in the midst of learning a new swing. He hung around the top of the leaderboard all weekend and ended up finishing tied for eighth place. O'Mara, on the other hand, played the best golf of his life and captured his first major championship. It was a poetic moment when Tiger, as the defending champion, placed the green jacket on his best friend on the tour. They had played countless hours of golf together over the previous 18 months, and Tiger's influence had inspired O'Meara to elevate his game. O'Meara said he was channeling a bit of Woods when he birdied three of the final four holes to secure his first major. Back at the rental house, an atmosphere of euphoria set in. Never expecting her husband to win, Alicia hadn't packed any formal wear. Peggy Lewis gathered up shoes and the dress and raced back to her home to help Alicia get ready for the champion's dinner. While Mark and Tiger got ready, Alicia and Peggy went next door to iron the dress and have a glass of wine with the neighbors. After a few minutes, Tiger entered the house next door to Lewis's in search of Alicia. Oh my God, Lewis thought. She knew Tiger was staying in her home, but she had yet to meet him. Excited, she stood and extended her hand. Hi, Tiger. My name is Peggy Lewis. You're staying in my house next door. Without saying a word, Tiger ignored Lewis's hand, turned to Alicia, and asked when they were leaving. Everyone stopped talking and looked at Lewis as she sheepishly withdrew her hand. Alicia looked at Tiger. I'll be over in a few minutes, she said. Humiliated, Lewis quietly sat down as Woods walked out, never acknowledging her. Tiger was pleased for O'Meara, who would go on to win the British Open a couple of months later. Meanwhile, his own game was rounding into form. In February, he had stormed back from an 8-stroke deficit in the final round to win the Johnny Walker Classic in Thailand. Even though Tiger had come up short at the 1998 Masters, he was a more complete player than he'd been a year earlier. In addition to being the second longest player on the tour, he had become much straighter, and he had quietly risen to second in scoring average. But it had been 9 months since he'd won a PGA Tour event, and he was sick of hearing, "What's wrong with Tiger?" Harmon kept reminding him that the only question that mattered was, "Are you on track?" And from Harmon's perspective, the answer was a definite yes. It was misleading to say Tiger was in a slump. It just appeared that way after such a dazzling start to his career. If anything, Tiger was a victim of his own success. He had set the bar so high that anything short of victory was deemed a failure. Behind the scenes, he had replaced his grip-it-and-rip-it approach with a more controlled swing that was intended to lower his trajectory. In a further effort to lower the flight of his ball, he had also switched to a graphite-shafted driver. His posture was different, too. All these changes went largely unnoticed, but Harmon could see what was coming. Tiger's swing overhaul was right on schedule, and the results were impressive. He had to keep reminding himself, "This kid is only 22 years old." In May 1998, Tiger won the Bell South Classic, giving him his first tour victory in 10 months and reinforcing in his mind that he was on the right track. Outside the ropes, however, he wasn't as sure of himself. After so many years of having parents who tightly controlled everything, Tiger was now learning life's lessons on his own. Other than Harmon, O'Meara was the one guy Tiger looked to for guidance. O'Meara urged him to try to be more approachable. Most people just wanted the thrill of being able to say, "Hey, Tiger Woods said hi to me," or "look me in the eye," he said. But it wasn't easy for Tiger to connect with strangers. He had enough trouble connecting with the other guys on tour. As a result, he spent a lot of time by himself. At a press conference following a tournament in 1998, Tiger was asked point blank, "Do you feel alone?" "No," he said abruptly. "I've got a lot of good friends, trust me." He did have a social life. At that time, he was playing golf with Kevin Costner, Glenn Frey, and Ken Griffey Jr. There was an endless list of celebrities and television personalities who wanted to be around him. But his relationship with actors, rock stars, and other elite athletes were more a result of him being the alpha male in the fraternity of fame. When it came to having someone he could actually go to for sound, unfiltered advice about life and the challenges he faced, Tiger essentially had the O'Meara's. They were the ones who were most likely to tell him what he needed to hear, as opposed to what he wanted to hear. But even with Mark, Tiger held back. He would seek his advice on the business side of golf and talk about sports, fishing, and the tour. But when it came to life and matters of the heart, Tiger was never comfortable around men, not even Mark. He would, however, occasionally drop his guard around Alicia. It helped that she never told him how to live his life, almost never talked to him about golf, and was not the least bit dazzled by his celebrity status. She also sensed that he needed to be around people and that he didn't really have anyone else. In particular, his fame made it very different to find a girl that he could trust. One evening, Tiger accompanied Mark and Alicia to a party at the home of tennis pro Todd Woodbridge in Isleworth. At one point, Tiger and Alicia ended up alone at the punch bowl.
How do you know who you can trust? Tiger said quietly.
You don't, Alicia said. Her answer intrigued him.
You just have to trust your instincts, she continued. It's hard because you're in this little bubble. You're going to have to reach out. You have to have relationships in your life.
Her words stuck with him. Later that summer, Tiger went to a party at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he had agreed to go on a date with a 20-year-old student named Joanna Jagoda. Born in Poland and raised in the San Fernando Valley, Jagoda was a political science major who had her sights on law school. A blonde who had been a cheerleader in high school, Jagoda soon became a familiar sight on the PGA Tour. Despite suddenly being in the bright spotlight that was trained on Tiger, she discreetly avoided the press and maintained a low profile. By the latter part of the 1998 season, she was traveling with Tiger and eventually moved into his Isleworth home. Mark and Alicia adored Joanna, who quickly became a leveling influence in Tiger's life. Shortly after she showed up, Tiger decided to take control of the decision-making process in his business affairs. From the beginning, the triangular relationship with his father and Hughes Norton had worn on him. In the summer of 1998, the three of them appeared on the cover of Golf Digest under the headline, The Father, The Son, and The Holy Ghost. Norton's ego was outsized to begin with and had only gotten bigger when Tiger came along. In their short time together, Norton had secured roughly $120 million in endorsement deals for Tiger. It was unprecedented. His corporate partners included Nike, Titleist, Planet Hollywood, American Express, Rolex, EA Sports, Asahi, Cobra, Golf Digest, Unilever, and Wheaties. The list just kept growing, and that was part of the problem. Mondays were essentially the only days on which Tiger had any free time, and increasingly, IMG was filling that time with sponsorship commitments that generated hefty commissions for the agency. In October 1998, less than 2 months after Norton was referred to as a deity in Golf Digest, Tiger decided that he no longer wanted him as his agent. The Los Angeles Times broke the news reporting, "This week, Norton was downgraded from Holy Ghost to just plain Ghost." The move was a blow to Norton's ego, one that forced him to admit that he hadn't seen it coming. "It's hard to understand the decision Tiger has made," Norton said. He added, "He earns more per endorsement than any other athlete in the world, including Michael Jordan." Norton was proud of the job he'd done for Tiger, but Norton was viewing his dismissal through the prism of money and deals, and Tiger saw things differently. More important, Mark O'Mara's view of Norton had changed. "Hughes was a hard-driven guy," O'Mara explained. "He would go for the jugular. I wanted an agent who was a little less confrontational and a little more professional." Nobody on tour had more influence over Tiger than O'Mara, and once he said goodbye to Norton, it was only a matter of time before Tiger did the same. As it was, Tiger had never really connected with Norton, who had been hand-picked by Earl. More and more, Tiger saw the agent as working for his father, not him. The decision to break with Norton was part of Tiger's effort to become his own man. At first, Earl argued to keep Norton. "He's been good to us," he told Cultita. "Let's give him another chance." "No," Cultita said. "Tiger don't like Hughes. He don't want to be with Hughes. I don't like Hughes. He gotta go." Once Norton's dismissal became public, Earl tried to appear as though he'd been behind the decision, telling the press that Norton had overcommitted Tiger. The truth was that, other than Tiger's book deal with Warner Books, Earl had been involved in every endorsement that Norton had pursued on Tiger's behalf. But Tiger would almost never publicly acknowledge fault in his father. Although he no longer allowed anyone, including Earl, to tell him what to do, he remained intensely protective of his father's reputation. When Earl made an ugly comment about the people of Scotland in the lead-up to the British Open, Tiger insisted that his father had never made the statement despite the fact that a reporter had it on tape. Tiger added, "My dad didn't mean any harm if he did say it, but I don't think he even said it." Similarly, the more he thought about it, Tiger just couldn't bring himself to sit for the interview he had promised to John Feinstein. So a few days before the start of the 1998 PGA Championship in Washington State, Tiger was on the putting green at Sahali Country Club when he dispatched an IMG employee to track down Feinstein. A few minutes later, Feinstein showed up. "Heard you were looking for me," he said. Tiger looked up and nodded. "Look, I'm sorry about this because I feel like I made a commitment, but I just can't do the thing with you in Atlanta for your book." "Okay. Is there a particular reason?" Yeah, I just can't get past what you've said and written about my father.
Feinstein didn't get it. His book had been out for 5 months. Besides, they'd been over this stuff.
I thought we talked all that out in San Diego, Feinstein said.
I thought we had too, but I just can't get past it, Tiger said.
After cutting ties with Norton, Tiger was ready to leave IMG altogether. But then CEO Mark McCormick stepped in and suggested that Tiger meet with a couple of young up-and-coming agents, including one who, unlike the others he dealt with at the agency, had not been born into privilege.
Mark Steinberg grew up in Peoria, Illinois, and earned a spot as a walk-on on the University of Illinois basketball team that in 1989 made it to the Final Four. After law school, he interned at IMG before being hired. His main assignment was to recruit players in women's golf, and his first big break came in 1993 when he signed Michelle McGann and Carrie Webb. The following year, he hit the equivalent of a hole-in-one when he brought Annika Sorenstam into the IMG fold. A year later, Sorenstam won the U.S. Women's Open, putting herself and Steinberg on the sports marketing map. Tiger agreed to meet with Steinberg. After the meeting, Steinberg explained his philosophy about time management. There is only so much these players can do, and there is only so much time in a day, he said. One of the challenges is creating the most efficient schedule for Tiger. Tiger had found the man he was looking for, a guy in his early 30s who'd played competitive sports in college and was just as interested in being Tiger's friend as he was in being his agent. The sudden presence of Steinberg and Joanna Jagoda were a stark signal from Tiger that he was shedding his past and forming a new inner circle, starting with two people from his own generation. Jagoda was a tempering influence, bringing a sense of calm to Tiger's frenetic lifestyle. It was not uncommon for them to spend their nights at home, and he went out of his way to protect her privacy. She's his secret weapon, and he's not about to throw her to the wolves of the golfing circuit, a tour source said. But Steinberg's experience with women's golf had not prepared him for the madness that surrounded his new client. Shortly after taking over as Tiger's agent, Steinberg traveled with him to England. The two of them were exiting a restaurant in London when the paparazzi pounced, shouting questions while their cameras clicked in rapid succession. Shell-shocked, Steinberg jumped in front of Tiger and started flailing his arms and trying to shield Tiger's face. While Steinberg looked like he was dancing on hot coals, Tiger calmly walked through the onslaught and ducked into the back seat of his car. Steinberg rushed around to the other side and got in. Tiger reached across the seat and put his arm around him. "Let's just understand," Tiger said. "My life is crazy. Welcome to my world. You're going to have to calm down a little bit."
Chapter 16. I got it.
Tiger Woods had never needed any external motivation, but he was getting a big dose of it from David Duval. While Tiger continued to reconstruct his swing, 26-year-old Duval won four PGA tournaments in 1998, finishing the year ranked number one on the lists of scoring average and money list leaders. Tiger ranked number two and number four, respectively, on those lists. And although he still clung to the number one ranking as the top golfer in the world, Duval had moved up to number three. In the minds of some golf writers and analysts, Duval was on his way to eclipsing Tiger as the game's top player. Tiger would never admit it publicly, but Duval was on his mind. In press conferences, he broke down Duval's play, and he could describe Duval's shots in intricate detail. The golf writers had been clamoring for a rivalry, and Duval emerged as the best candidate to challenge Tiger's supremacy, especially after he kicked off the 1999 season by winning the Mercedes Championships and 2 weeks later, the Bob Hope Chrysler Classic, where he shot a record 59 in the final round. Those two wins pushed him past Tiger in overall tour victories, 9-7, and knocked Tiger out of the number one overall ranking. The mounting debate over who was the preeminent golfer came at a time when Tiger was thinking seriously about making another major change in his team. Heading into the Buick Invitational at Torrey Pines in early February, Tiger asked his closest high school friend, Byron Bell, to caddy for him. Tiger had remained close to Bell through college and his first couple of years on the tour. It was Bell who had been instrumental in introducing Tiger to Joanna Jagoda. After Tiger struggled through the first two rounds at Torrey Pines, narrowly making the cut, Bell knew exactly what to say.
You are so talented that if you play well, there is no one who can beat you, he told Woods. Now go out and put up a number. On Saturday, Tiger shot 62, a record on the demanding South course and his lowest round as a pro. It catapulted him past the 41 players who'd been ahead of him, landing Tiger atop the leaderboard by one stroke. He maintained that momentum on the final day,